Right, members and audience, we will call this committee hearing to order. This is the meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee, Monday, January 28th, 2013. I apologize, members, we're starting a few minutes late, contrary to my commitment at the start of session. We had a little bit of technical difficulty, but today, members, we're going to hear from Commissioner Charles A. Zelli, for the purpose of considering his confirmation. We'll be taking a vote at the conclusion of that hearing on whether or not to recommend his confirmation to the full Senate. A couple of announcements. You might have gotten the reminder from the sergeant's office about microphones in the committee rooms. I decided to go ahead and print that off and put it in your packet. Just a word to the wise. You can chat all you want, but just don't do it near the microphone because it'll be taped and broadcast all over the entire building. So it's just for the best. Unless it's really juicy and then we all want to hear it. You probably noticed this big three-ring binder. Binder is full of budget materials, as a matter of fact. So we will. So these will be our budget books. Today, of course, we're going to be hearing from the Department of Public Safety. We'll get the agency overview, and then we'll be referring to the material in the binder when they present the governor's proposed budget. Not yet in that, but we'll have that by Wednesday, are the budget materials for MnDOT and the Met Council. And we will hold on to these unless you feel strongly. Otherwise, we can hang on to these and bring them, lug them back and forth for you. If you do take them, you're on your own. We're not going to replace them. So just go ahead and leave them on the table, and we'll lug them back and forth and bring them to committee on those days when we're considering budgetary matters. With that, we will commence with the confirmation hearing for Charlie Zelli. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Zelli. And before we start, if you wouldn't mind letting us know how Bernie Arsenault is doing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a great honor to be here before the committee. I was here on my second day, so it's delightful to be here on my, I think, eighth or ninth day. I've lost count now, so that's a good thing. Deputy Commissioner Arsenault is recovering at home. He's doing well. Thank you all for your good wishes. He has been in touch, and he is following his doctor's advice to kind of stay home and relax for 4 to 6 weeks. So I expect he'll be back full steam as soon as he's able, but we're encouraging him to take the time. But I think it was a very successful surgery, and he's in good shape.
Great. Thank you. Commissioner, the floor is yours. How would you like to use your time? We'd like to allot about 20 minutes or so to this hearing.
Well, maybe I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will just kind of be brief and give just a quick overview of maybe just my resume, a little bit about my background. You may have my resume before you. I know that the administration would like to talk about accomplishments of the agency, and I'm happy to talk about those. I just thought I'd spend just a little bit talking about my vision, the department's vision, how I feel that kind of how thrilled I am to help support that those themes, and then maybe kind of open it up for questions because I know that you will probably leave most of the time for that.
Great, thank you.
First off, I've had
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, in looking at the presentation that's ahead of us, I would ask that would you allow enough time, equal amount of time for questions as there is in terms of presentation as well. So if there's 20 minutes of presentation, could we allow up to 20 minutes for questions?
Sure. Senator Peterson, I don't think the commissioner is going to take 20 minutes to present, we can take as much time for questions. I'm just targeting 20 minutes because we have the Department of Public Safety to deal with.
Thank you.
I'm not going to cut things off at 20 minutes. It's entirely up to the committee how long we spend with the commissioner. So we can take 2.5 hours on questions and call DPS back, but I hope we don't do that. Thanks. Commissioner.
Thank you. I was hoping to take maybe less than 10 minutes on a presentation, so I'll be really brief. And in fact, I will really kind of focus on this page There's additional presentation about some of MnDOT's existing efforts, which I expect to be, following up on. But I first just wanted to mention my experience, which is over 20 years operating a bus company, Jefferson Lines. I grew up in the business, working at it in summers. That does not hit my resume, but in that I'm a third generation Zully in this business. My grandfather started it in 1919. It was called the Jefferson Highway Transportation Company, and it was operated on the Jefferson Highway, which ran from Winnipeg all the way to New Orleans through Brainerd and Minnesota. And so the original road was a dirt road, and Jefferson buses ran on it at that time. I had no intention of being in the family business. I was in New York in finance after business school, but the company was really struggling. It had a real estate investments along the Mississippi River, and I took a year's kind of a year off from Merrill Lynch and thought I would help the family business. That was over 25 years ago, and it was a business that was struggling. And like any time you work on something that's struggling, you get to know it, and I got to love it, and I stuck with it. And as I'd say, one of the luckiest things that ever happened in my life was struggling with a business at that time in my life, because I really learned a lot. I learned a lot starting about 10 years ago when the Itasca project started forming, and I got the assignment to help co-chair a transportation initiative to help think about the region transportation issues that would help promote a long-term prosperity and quality of life in Minnesota. I thought I knew about transportation because I was operating a bus company, but I really learned quite a bit more about the public issues facing transportation. One thing I learned as a bus guy and also working on the transportation issues with the Itasca project is that different modes are interconnected. There is no kind of one solution. There's many different modes, freight, passenger, bus, rail, road, and that they are all something that fit closely together. And it is with that perspective I come to MnDOT, which has a multimodal strategy. I pursued more transportation initiatives with my work with Chambers of Commerce, both at the Minneapolis Regional Chamber and then the State Chamber of Commerce, and also helping form Greater MSP, which promotes retention and attraction of new businesses to the state. I come at it with a private sector bias that transportation is a bedrock of our economy toward jobs, toward all citizens' prosperity, whether you're an employer, whether you're a citizen taking a road or a bus on your way to work or on the way to school. I know that it touches every citizen in the state. And so in that case, I really like the vision of the agency to support a world-class transportation system. But what I've said within our agency already is that we don't have roads or transit systems or rail lines just for the sake of having them. They're there for a purpose, and that is to promote a world-class state. And how we can be meaningfully engaged with this infrastructure into our economy is what's most important. And it seems obvious, but I think that kind of consideration is something I'm really looking forward to helping promote. I think the visions and the directions of the agency are right on. And I've listed a number of themes. Those are themes that are very consistent with some of the strategies that have been articulated in the MnDOT presentations and in how it's organized. But I'm really hoping to kind of put even more flesh on those words. Transparency needs to be linked closely to accountability. I know there's real questions, and I think MnDOT could do a better job at answering some of the questions of how our project prioritized. What is the cost of a project? What are the goals that we want to hold ourselves as an agency accountable to? Resiliency and adaptability is really important themes, whether it be issues of climate change, flooding, or changes in our population. We're building projects for the next generation, so how we think about that is part of the themes of being adaptable. I've often said within just this past 2 weeks that this is not revolution, but we do believe in evolution, and we survive by being adaptable and thinking about how we think about innovation is not just in bridge design. It's how we might finance a bridge, or it might be how it relates to other modes to help meet passenger demands. Integrated and forward thinking. Integrated in the economy of our state. Forward thinking in terms of what is the best practice, even outside of the state of Minnesota. Fortunately, this is an agency which is often looked on by other states as a model, but I think we could also learn from international models about what could be some best practice for the agency. So I'm looking forward to opening up the agency to new ideas. I think my relationships with private sector businesses might be helpful in terms of providing some outside resources, helps, best thinking. And in that regard, I was very skipping back to TFAC. I was part of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee over the past year as a private sector representative. I learned a lot about the agency, and I will be coming back to help talk about that study, that work, and its recommendations perhaps later this week. But I think that in doing so, I think that the MnDOT has some great analysts and planners that has been a resource for that advisory committee, which was not just public sector of all parties, but private sector economists. And others were part of that process. So the one last thing to kind of mention, Jefferson Lines, as I mentioned, I left the company as an employee and as an officer on December 31st, and I continue, my family continues to have a controlling interest, and I remain on their board. But I mentioned to the governor that there were contracts that the company has with MnDOT associated with some federal programs providing services, transportation to rural areas in Minnesota, as we do in many states, 13 different states. So I have taken the initiative to outline that conflict and put together a framework with the governor's office as to how I would both recuse myself and absent myself from anything that it relates to Jefferson and MnDOT, both on the MnDOT side and then also on the Jefferson side. So I would not have any influence on that relationship. But having been a president for that company for 20 years, I'm acutely aware of how the benefits of transportation networks are to the industry. So that's my general overview. I'm very open to answering questions and having another conversation.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Zelli. Just for the record, I'll note that a quorum is present. Questions, members? Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zelli, can you just spend a minute or two more talking about the relationship with Jefferson Lines that you foresee? Is that kind of ad infinitum, or do you see it having a natural transition out of that? I mean, I can appreciate moving from an executive role there to an executive role here and wanting to make sure, I mean, your commitment to that organization and wanting to make sure there's a smooth transition. I mean, is it a transitioning out over time, or do you anticipate having kind of a perpetual potential conflict of interest, even if you're recusing yourself? It's
Commissioner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, the company is 93 years old, and our family has had it for that time, so I'm not quite sure what our long-term ownership stake will be. There is a president CEO now in place. He was the chief financial officer, and I had been in a conversation with him over the past several years of him assuming the role of a chief operating officer and getting into the leadership, and we advanced that conversation timetable, but I think the company's in good hands, and I really am taking kind of more of a my own evolution of to step away from the company. We do have partners, other investors. One significant one who owns 40% is a person who was in the bus industry for many years. He lives in Texas, and he plays a very prominent role in both advising, and he will have a direct relationship with the president. So I don't see my role as active, and I think the company's in good hands.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Underwriter.
And Mr. Zelli, just something to ponder. I know you know that you help Service Duluth, and some of the other folks in the Duluth area have some concerns about this potential conflict. So, you know, as you move forward, and you'll have my support in this process, I think officially transitioning off the board at some point is probably helpful just to eliminate perception. And as we know, perception can sometimes become reality. So,
okay. Thank you.
Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. To follow up on that same point, when we talked this morning, excuse me, I appreciated you coming down and giving me that extra time this morning. You had mentioned that the Minnesota Department of Transportation had kind of come to Jefferson when Greyhound walked away from or gave up these, for lack of a better term, I guess, interstate passenger bus routes. Is that what you call them?
Yes.
And MnDOT came to you. And so I think my concern is similar to Senator Reinhart's. And can you expand a little bit on how you and the governor have talked about how are you going to, are you simply just going to not be in the room when these are talked about, these grants, or how are you going to get information about these grants once they happen? Can you give us a little more detail in terms of how you and the governor's office have worked out this separation that you're talking about?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, yes, this is a program that's run nationally that provides some rural assistance, marketing, some operating, just in order to enable service to what are really unprofitable rural areas. When Greyhound cut back its service, I think it was in 2004, they cut back around the entire country. This program was in place, so MnDOT and asked of any carriers, Jefferson offered to provide both a local match, so these are still unprofitable routes, even for Jefferson, with assistance, is kind of sharing of the loss. So this is after doing a study, the Office of Transit within MnDOT puts together requests for proposals, and all kind of bus companies or carriers are kind of express proposals. And I think it's around a 2-year cycle. So how the governor's office and I have structured this is that the governor's office will appoint a person within MnDOT who would be tasked with overseeing that intercity part of the Office of Transit. So it's a small part in a greater context. I will not have any authority really to both know about, be in deliberations of, or review any applications or proposals. Similarly, on the Jefferson side, I'm, of course, not part of management, but I've expressly said I will not be part of any planning or deliberations associated with those proposals. And then when it comes before the board, I will not be in the room. There'll be enough board members who'll be able to act on that on Jefferson's side. I will hear about it after the fact, but I think that my guidance and influence won't be felt on either side.
And follow up. Thank you, Commissioner, and I believe you, and I appreciate your sincerity there. Could you just take a moment and address any other municipalities? For example, we talked briefly this morning about Ramsey County and your relationship, and you obviously have equipment rolling into the Union Depot as well, and Do you anticipate a similar type situation when your company's dealing with other municipalities besides the state?
Commissioner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, Senator, the Jefferson regularly in many states has relationships with local transit, municipalities, counties, where it has perhaps an agency in one city or a renting a ticket counter, which is the case in the Ramsey County operated Union Station. So in that case, I will not, I really, as my full-time job as MnDOT commissioner, will not be engaged in that activity at Jefferson. It is a normal practice. Jefferson Lines has a relationship with Amtrak, with many transit providers, where it does some innovative ticketing, through ticketing, but that's just not something that would come to the board level and not something I would really be engaged with.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, members? Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Commissioner Zelli, I guess on the conflict issue, while we're on it, and then I'd like to move into just a philosophy or questions on some other of the reports. You were talking about how the governor would appoint somebody else in MnDOT for those decisions. The inherent problem I find is, or at least I'd ask about is, I mean, you're still that MnDOT employee's ultimate supervisor or boss. Wouldn't there still be an inherent desire or conflict with that person to make sure the outcome is something you're happy with? With other financial interests? There always could be that fear of retribution and maybe let me back up. What kind of decisions would they make? I'm assuming it would be competitive bids. Maybe another company is putting in a similar proposal to be awarded and take away bus lines or routes that you might already serve, or am I misunderstanding that?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, it's kind of an interesting process because it isn't just a contract like a transit line. This is how communities and different resources are stitched together. So actually it's not like a profitable venture where the company gets additional resources. It's a way to expand the reach into additional rural areas that can act as feeder routes for Jefferson routes in this case. I think that the person who would be in charge of that area away from me would have the benefit of staff, the clear metrics as to what the criteria would be. I believe that's usually done with advisory folks that go even outside of MnDOT. So I don't think it would be these decisions, hopefully, and I don't think they have been made on a very arbitrary basis. So I think there would be a well-founded support that would be kind of so it wouldn't be subject to a subjective decision. Hopefully that's kind of outlined in a very methodical way. So I don't think whoever that person is designated by the governor's office should have fear of retribution. And my opinion.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just follow up on that matter. If you could explain a little more, is it more of a negotiation? I mean, is it such that it's Jefferson Lines that's willing to take some of these routes and nobody else is trying to compete for them? And I'm just trying to get a little better understanding. It sounds like maybe more if it's a continual negotiation rather than an RFP. And the subsequent question to that is, how do you stay in business if ultimately you're losing money on all these lines just to do a good deed for the state?
Well, thank you, Chairman. Senator, you're right. I don't think Jefferson would be in business if this is all it did. but I think it's it is not a negotiation. I think the state Office of Transit offers priorities and accepts proposals from a variety of different companies and accepts proposals, you know, or pieces or parts of a proposal. It's not. I don't think it's really a negotiation. It's very tied into and subject to pretty strict FTA rules because this is federal transit funding. So it's a lot of the guidelines are set by the federal policy and not the state. State kind of administers this for Minnesota, just as Iowa, Kansas, North and South Dakota. Most states have this program, so it's not an arbitrary MnDOT kind of program. It is more MnDOT is really the because it's the state agency is the kind of conduit for a federal program.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Just on
Senator
that
Westbrook.
On that issue, is it all federal funds that basically are passing through the state agency then?
Yeah, that is correct. There are no state funds. It is 100% federal funding.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
just on a different question, thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Zelli. The TFAC report that you mentioned you were a part of, can I ask you specifically, there's a provision about mileage, a mileage tax or a mileage fee that would be put on vehicles that the committee is embracing. I understand, and correct us if you're wrong, you were one of the affirmative votes on that report, specifically to the mileage fee or tax where a device would be put on vehicles based on the number of miles they'd have to pay a fee. Can you express your support for that or opposition or thoughts about that concept to this committee?
Well, Commissioner, I was on the TFAC as well. I think embracing is a bit of a strong term. I think it's in the list of things to look at, but I don't think there's a full embrace of the mileage-based user fee. But Commissioner, proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think, Senator, that's correct. It is one of a list of possible sources of revenue for the future that we should took that the agency or the state should look seriously at. It is not one of the main sources of funding to address the unmet need, you know, in the near term. My feeling about it, and I voted for the TFAC recommendations as a whole, not, you know, specific parts of it. I think mileage-based ways of measuring road use and garnering more revenue is probably inevitable for all states and the country, but we're not there yet. The costs of collecting that, the concern about a number of things, privacy and what's fair and areas where there's larger miles driven, like in rural Minnesota and versus urban Minnesota. I think there's a lot of issues that need to be worked out. I know that Minnesota's done some great work through the University of Minnesota. It's being tested in Oregon, I believe Arizona. So I think this is going to be part of the conversation we're going to have here in Minnesota as well as the rest of the other states. And so my feeling is we ought to be continuing that conversation because more revenue is really required for maintaining our system, but I it's not anything I would be promoting in the short term.
One last question for now, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your earlier remarks, you just briefly brushed over climate change or global warming and how that fits into the agency. I would be interested just in your remark there and how do you think it fits into the agency? Is it crisis mode where we need to make huge changes? What would you see your role in the agency and reacting to global warming that, of course, it's a politically popular concept right now, but there's also some of us that don't believe it's proven science. Can you just share with us a little more of your comment and where you would see the agency going relating to that type of science?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I may have been glib in my introductory comments. What I meant was even areas like considering climate change should be considered in how we can maintain a resilient system. More specifically, we have experienced a number of floods and major storm damage. This last year in Duluth and in Cannon Falls area, there was really kind of harmful, damage to the roadway and bridges, and MnDOT was able to respond very quickly to help shore up the immediate need and then work toward doing some more ongoing repairs. And so what I meant by that statement was that I would help support, maybe even accelerate, some of the other initiatives that have been identified, such as being able to consider those areas of our infrastructure that are in flood-related areas, where we've identified a number of measures like opening up culverts and allowing if a flood were to occur, the roadway and the bridge systems would be able to handle it, and thereby reducing the cost of both interruption and repair should difficult weather come. So I don't think I need to have that dependent upon climate change. I think, good practice for severe weather.
Well, Commissioner, certainly the state needs to figure out how to respond with policies and resources and practices to warming that's occurring. We've just been the beneficiary of 2 days of hearings last week that gave us some perspective on the steps we're going to have to take in consideration of both drought and flood issues and a whole bunch of other effects and that's going to have a huge implication for our transportation sector. But we also know through the studies of the Minnesota Climate Action Group that undertook a very intensive examination of where we look to for greenhouse gases, what sectors and activities in Minnesota are responsible for greenhouse gases, so that we can get to the statutory goal that we have of reducing our greenhouse gases by 80% in a few years' time. The transportation sector was identified as having a key role to play. And in fact, the goals of the transportation system, as outlined in our own directives to the Department of Transportation as they carry out their chief responsibilities and function in transportation, are to reduce greenhouse gases. Okay. So prevention is an important part of MnDOT's established statutory directive. So I'm sure you already have, but I'd encourage you to read the goals of the Department of Transportation in its Chapter 74, as well as the commissioner's powers and duties. They speak to some of these environmental responsibilities that you're going to have once you're confirmed.
Thank you, Chairman. Sustainability and being environmentally kind of ahead of the curve is part of the vision of the department. So.
And the University of Minnesota, in follow-up to the report of the MCAG, we call it, the Minnesota Climate Action Group, which was established by Governor Pawlenty, undertook a fairly thorough analysis of what we could achieve with existing technology and some change in policy in transportation to meet those goals, and they found that actually the transportation sector could achieve its portion of those goals fairly simply and actually with a benefit to our economy. So I have Senator Senjum on the list and then Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and And Mr. Zelli, just I have three questions. I think two are pretty quick, and just a couple of words in terms of my answer. I think, help me if you will a little bit. It's been established, I believe I've written that you still either have some stock ownership or some personal ownership in Jefferson Line. Is that right?
That is correct,
Commissioner. Okay. Just secondly, are you a paid board member or is that a voluntary?
I do receive a board fee.
Okay. And my second one is, I'll just shift gears now, for at least some of us that live in regional centers with MnDOT offices, I want to get some idea of what your leadership and management style might be relative to regional offices. To we who live in outstate Minnesota, the regional office is our MnDOT, if you will. But obviously we have a big office up here as well. Thinking about your regional style and your management approach, are you a strong centrist, or are you one that is willing to give responsibilities to, say, regional offices and let them pretty much run their show, have their authority? And I get to the question I had last week, where do we go, who do we ask? Would a legislator be better positioned to ask their regional office for help with local MnDOT problems, or do they have to come to the commissioner? One would hope you wouldn't have to come to the commissioner, but I want to get some idea of your level of empowerment relative to regional offices and district engineers.
Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Senator, that's a great question, and the one I have been learning about, both how MnDOT has his practice, and then maybe you're asking my own philosophical view. Mm-hmm. Start with that. I think there's always an appropriate balance. Philosophically, I think those closest to their customers, their communities, are the best to know what is appropriate and how to respond. And so as much as the power is throughout our districts, that's very appropriate. And I think our district engineers have my understanding, and those that I have met, and I've met nearly all of them in 2 weeks, have a really good handle and feel for both the community and the transportation needs. Having said that, I think in terms of efficiency and streamlining, there should be some consistency of how, the agency practices allocates its funding, some of the best practices, kind of even within a large organization. It's important that we handle it professionally in all parts of the state. So it's always a balancing act. It depends on the actual issue. I think that having plans kind of start in the field and then come up and then work its way back again, that there is a process, not just this or that. I think it's how there's communication between the central office and the field. I'm looking forward to spending more time myself, getting to know the issues and getting to know the district engineers and how we in a sense, can support their efforts. So I think that it's never going to be one or the other. Mm-hmm. It's really just appropriate to have that balance.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, lastly, and don't take this question wrong, we don't do background checks, but just to ask, in your view, is there anything in your life, your resume or anything else that would be politically embarrassing if you were ultimately confirmed and some were to report?
I know one, but we discussed earlier. But I won't mention
that my political contributions.
It's a little joke.
I'm talking about reasonable people, not unreasonable people.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, I have actually tried to. I've been trying to think of issues that would be embarrassing, and other than my normal life, as everybody has, I can't think of one that I would. I had a question that somebody, a friend, asked and said, "You know, there's so much. You've been out there. Everybody already knows about me already. So I don't sure there's many dark."
Mr. Chairman, it sounds like me fairly.
Senator.
Boring individual.
I should get out more.
Very good.
And Commissioner, I can't remember if you were here when Senator Senjum was asking the question, where does it all happen? That was a variant of that question. And it's also my burning question, and it's, I think, one of the questions we really want to explore and understand as a committee so that we can support the work of MnDOT, so we can understand how the list is developed so that we don't start developing it on MnDOT's behalf, which is something we want to avoid. So we really need to drill down and understand the professionalism, the analysis, the methods by which MnDOT really does figure out how to allocate resources, whether that's in the central office or out in the district offices. So we look forward to exploring the where does it happen question with you in the coming months.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that's a great question. I have been asking that myself. And I think it is perceived as a mystery, and I think internally there's a little bit of mystery. I'm convinced there is a process. I think it's a good one. How we can get more transparency is the overused word, but how we can kind of start articulating that prioritization process as well as the need, and that I think the public and you deserve that. So I will be working on a first understanding and then articulating and then working with you as to what that is.
Here's the queue members. We have Senator Osmick, Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Pratt. Still want to hear from the Department of Public Safety today. So, Senator Osmick.
I'll be brief, Senator. Chairman. Mr. Zelli, a couple of questions. One is, what do you feel is the most pressing transportation need for Minnesota, and how do you feel, with your role as the leader of a department, how would you be accomplishing that?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I think that the agency has really, I'm impressed at the work it's been doing, delivering projects, planning, but I think there will be a continuing need for both the transparency issue we just discussed, also being able to kind of quantify and understand where the real costs are in the system. I'm coming from the private sector, and I know that understanding kind of where the numbers are, where there's opportunities for savings, where resources can be redeployed because there's more need than resources available. I think that is something that I am very interested in, and I think would be very helpful, particularly in a context of scarce resources, that we use them prudently. So that's so I think understanding and getting a handle on the numbers and learning how we can do it's done well. The agency's done well. In terms of investing in high return projects, it's going to be a continuing debate and one I'm most interested in.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Zelli, to that point, so cost benefit analysis, those are something that you really place high value on, that projects that return $2 or $3 or $4 per dollar of investment are far higher priorities on your list than other projects that may only deliver 40 cents on a dollar's worth of investment. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, and maybe sometimes Mr. Chairman, how the assumptions that underline the return is also a very important debate. But yes, I think that if this transportation system is integrated with our economy, we should understand how it promotes economic development, how in some cases these are long lead time investments. So developing corridors that are really critical for even the capacity that isn't required at this moment, but to where the state's growing. I mean, I think there's a lot of variables. We should understand what those variables are. Everybody can kind of make different interpretations of numbers. So there's no kind of one correct number, but at least having that conversation makes more explicit those issues that are before us and that we can help create sense of urgency for.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Zelli, couple more quick questions. One recommendation that came out of TFAC was a gradual increase in gas tax of up to 40 cents. How do you reconcile that position with TFAC and you being a member of that organization with the governor's position, which appears to be that he isn't interested in that, in raising the gas tax? Is that, how would you reconcile that?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator. I've actually spoken to the governor and the governor's staff. I was there when he said at our news briefing where he announced my appointment that he thought the gas tax was not politically viable. He also said perhaps the commissioner can get out and talk about the need a little bit and the political interest might shift. So I did not hear him say it was a bad idea. And he also has been very supportive of our agency and me telling the story, because in many cases this is a nonpartisan issue of arithmetic and need, and to the extent I can talk about that, the governor's very open and interested. In fact, I think in his budget he has certainly signaled that transportation infrastructure is important. It's important for our economy, and he's offered resources to back that up. So I see every signal from the governor as not being anti-transportation infrastructure. I think he really recognizes that it's important. So I would intend to go out and tell this story, and that the TFAC report is, and other reports are really grounded in facts. And I think we certainly have a green light to tell those facts.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Zelli, one final question. Recently, technology has begun to develop of license plate recognition systems, almost sort of like facial recognition systems. And some jurisdictions are using those plate recognition systems to develop databases. From a policy perspective, do you believe that MnDOT and the system as a whole should be going in that direction of storing that information, or should it be limited, very limited in scope? There are many people that feel that there could be Fourth Amendment questions regarding unreasonable use of information or search and seizure. How do you feel about that subject?
So I'm not sure, Commissioner, if this is in the purview of MnDOT. Feel free to answer the question. This is probably more of a Department of Public Safety question, but I have a bill for you to sign, I think you'd like, Senator.
Perhaps.
All right. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that I know that technology is available. My view would be that until there's an express purpose, we won't be engaged in collecting data until we know what that data is for, and that it, obviously the issues of privacy and some of your concerns are something that would have to be debated. So we don't have any initiative. I think that if you think about tolling, there certainly is license plate recognition aspect there, as long with other transponders. It isn't just our agency, as I said. This would be if that's something that starts to occur, it would be not just public safety, but I know municipalities are dealing with that now.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Good to see you again.
Sure.
The issue that I'm going to bring up, you talk about transportation. While sometimes right now we hear a lot about transit rail, we hear the rumbling under our feet many times. However, there are two issues here that I think are really important. That is that the large majority of people use roads, and a lot of our commerce, business, tourism of our state are very dependent upon those roads. There are two issues here then. One is roads themselves. Secondly is the equitable distribution of dollars. I come from a district, District 3, that gets maybe 82% of their dollars returned back to their district, and yet is a high needs district. Interregional corridors, both 94, Highway 10, tourism, business, huge amount of traffic goes through there that is both local, school buses moving around in those same areas, and safety issues. And so what might be your plan in regards to helping make sure that there's a better equitable distribution, both on the basis of needs and then some of these district decisions. I mean, because our folks in District 3 can do a great job, but if they get less funding, then is it's an important. So can you maybe just comment on that subject?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I know that the equitable distribution is an issue. I probably will continue to be. I know that over time that there's kind of years when that could vary depending on the project. And I think that the agency needs to respond to kind of a thoughtful plan that is a statewide plan, and that we do the best with the available resources. So I think, my view is that corridor there is one that obviously has some really strong needs. It is an area of growth, and there's opportunities with additional resources where some major projects can make a difference. It is, as my elected official who's a friend said, Charlie, you understand that you're going to disappoint a lot of people and they're going to be mad at you. And I said, well, I've been in the bus business disappointing people for 20 years, so I know what that's like. So I'm sure it will be disappointing in many times, but every so often there's a project that's going to make sense. So I think if you have a long enough time horizon, I think there's something for all districts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think just a quick comment in that regard. I think in our district or in our area, we've seen and been patient in regards to understanding that. We understand it's a statewide plan and you wait your turn. It's just that at some point the turn needs to come, or it truly is not equitable and doing that. And so what I'm hearing is the restlessness of folks in that area saying, you know, it's time has come, and that's really important. One of the things I was wondering, though, and curious about in the TFAC report, is there anything in there? You mentioned you voted for it in its sense. Can you just clarify a little bit of the areas that you might support or not support or a change in direction, especially as commissioner? You get to exert a little bit of that influence in your direction, if you might comment on what those might be.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, I'll just mention that the TFAC report was advisory, and it was the direction of the governor was designed was directed to really drill down and examine and illustrate, examine the opportunities, examine the problem, and really state, in its fullness, in the view of in this collaborative setting. Given the best information that was brought forward, the commissioner is now a direct report of the governor, and we have a budget that we're going to see on Wednesday. I suspect the commissioner, in service to the governor, will be interested in seeing about supporting that budget. So I think we can anticipate some of the outline of his response. So long-winded way of saying, and we are, by the way, members going to see the full TFAC report. I don't know if I mentioned that, but the TFAC report is going to be brought forward, so we have the benefit of its presentation. But it is advisory only. It was advisory to the governor, and it was a best stab at really illustrating the extent of the problem. The governor took it under advisement, has submitted a budget. Commissioner now works at the service of the governor. So,
Mr. Chairman, I was recognizing that change, and that's because it's a matter of being a commissioner now that it is in a confirmation hearing. I think it is appropriate, but recognize.
But
thank you.
I picked up a line of questioning from a couple of members trying to find some space between the commissioner and the governor because of the TFAC reports, and I don't think you're going to find that, and I don't think, frankly, that would be appropriate for the commissioner to be trying to step away from the governor and his recommendations at this point. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Senator, I think that's correct. I was a part of the advisory committee, and I voted in favor of the recommendation and the conclusion. And now, in this new role, I have the great honor to actually present it. But I'm presenting what was the work of this group of 19 people, and so I might be able to articulate the arithmetic and lay out the issues. The recommendation is from the committee, not from MnDOT. So that's an appropriate clarification. And then certainly it is a response to the governor, who asked the right question, in my opinion, which is, what will it take to be a world-class system? And the TFAC worked to answer that question. So so I'm looking forward to kind of like helping present it, among others who will speak to it. But in terms of my role as the commissioner, I will be working with the administration and within the agency to do the best we can with the resources that have been allotted to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator. We have Senator Pratt and then Senator Carlson. Members, it's 4 o'clock.
Mr. Chair, I had raised my hand.
All right, and then Senator Westrom.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw my question. I believe it's already been answered.
All right, thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I guess I'd like to know a little bit about your management style. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being a hands-off, delegate everything, delegate the responsibility, not take responsibility for anything, versus a 10, which is a micromanager, wanting to have your fingers into everything and also ready to take responsibility. Where are you on a scale like that, and will we be seeing you, a lot of you?
Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I think you will be seeing me. But to answer the specific question, I think I'm probably in the middle. I'm more of a situational management. There are some areas where I know that I am not the best person to be involved. I want to make sure that the right people, as I, in my former job, that people are on the right seat, but that they're on the bus. We're here together, and that my task is first and foremost to lead the agency, to make sure that we have the right folks there, and I have a very collaborative style. So I am not coming in saying I've got the answers. I'm there to help learn and help support the innovation and the strengths of the agency, and maybe to open it up a little bit. So I'm not a 10 or a 1. I'm a very appreciative of those who are actually getting the work done. I know that in many times the commissioners maybe sometimes remove, so I want to make sure I have a good appreciation, but not to be in the way.
Thank you.
Senator Westrom.
Chair, I'll try to be brief here with some of the questions talking about reform. You talked about the more needs than money and all the time. Broadly speaking, and then I want to give you a specific example, Commissioner Zelli, just what is your commitment to reform or ideas of reform? And I talk about reform in the agency sense of what can we do to deliver a product for the same price or less money, in knowing that there's not an infinite amount of money. We can't just always raise the tax. The public's going to not allow that at some point. So the idea of reform in the department, what would be some ideas? What's your commitment to it? How do you go about seeking reform, or what reform do you kind of bring to the table, or is that just an idea that isn't part of your management style? Let me give you a specific example. About 12 years ago, actually Senator Marty here in the Senate and myself when I was in the House pursued, and I don't know if you've heard of a different transit system called Personal Rapid Transit. There's a Taxi 2000 invented, designed by an engineer from the U of M. It's an idea of reform that could augment our system, I still think, today. Are you familiar with that, and how does that concept, does the DOT keep looking at those ideas to try to improve, or where does reform fit in your agenda, and give me some ideas or comfort of how you bring that into the system, and specifically Taxi 2000. Are you familiar with that type of a concept?
Commissioner.
Chairman, Senator, I am familiar with Taxi 2000, and I was a friend of Sheffer Lang and some of the group that was supporting it. I am very interested in innovation and new ideas. Having said that, I believe concepts need to be peer-reviewed, need to be fully vetted and integrated so that in this for the public sector investments, probably have a lower tolerance for risk to make sure that that we don't sustain a loss that is effective. Having served on the Center for Transportation Studies Executive Committee for 6 years, I really was exposed to some of the power of the research that's being done at the university and wells within MnDOT and certainly at the Volpe Center and USDOT, that where transportation is going, how we can be open to the future is really very important. I think some of the work we've been doing with intelligent transportation systems, ITS doesn't mean a personal driverless vehicle, but it could. It could also mean just simple safety measures. I mean, I think there's a whole range that can be brought in. And I think that innovation and reform, as I've said, I really don't believe in revolution, but I truly believe in evolution, that we have to keep adapting and moving forward and considering not cutting edge, not bleeding edge, but forward thinking is an important value. But doing that in a prudent manner as opposed to one that exposes the agency or the public sector to too much risk. We have a lower tolerance of risk than, I think, private sector. But having said that, there's sometimes, partnerships that might be able to offer some innovation. So I guess my statement would be I'm very open to it. I would want to pursue new ideas, but make sure that it's in a context that makes sense for its use.
Thanks.
Members, I'll just mention that Commissioner mentioned the Volpe Center, which is now headed up by Bob Johns, who used to head up the Center for Transportation Studies here in Minnesota. Center for Transportation Studies is going to be our host on Thursday. So, Senator Champion, then we have Franz, and then we have Central.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Commissioner, I noticed from your highlights you articulate for 2013 and 2014 themes of transparency and accountability, resiliency and adaptability, integrated and forward thinking. But I don't see anything there around inclusion of women and people of color and veterans. So I am one who really believes in inclusion for a number of different reasons. But if we want to make sure that our public sector and workforce reflects the diversity of our community, that we have to be very intentional. And especially when we want to alleviate our safety net programs and just be, continue to be globally competitive. So can you briefly speak to your commitment, if any, to that level of diversity and inclusion, and what are some of your plans in order to make sure that all are reflective in not only MnDOT, but in its procurement?
And Senator Champion, I would just call your attention to the fourth slide, on the flip side of your paper, where he does make some mention of that topic. Commissioner.
Thank you, Chairman. Senator, it is actually in the PowerPoint, but I've, in terms of brevity, did not read each one. But that is a program that is within MnDOT, and it is a flagship, in other words, a high priority for the agency, and I would expect to be engaged. In fact, I already have been, and learning more and supporting the efforts toward diversity. In my view, this is in the agency's very best interests in a number of different levels. In part, this is the workforce of our future. And so when I say forward-thinking and adaptable, that is very much part of the being able to develop, train, and recruit disadvantaged, less represented folks, employees, and contractors. And I know from my experience that doesn't just happen. We have goals. We hope to be transparent with our goals. But our work with a group called the Collaborative, which has made some great headway, What we need to do is to work both in providing the resources, which we have, to help train and recruit people, but actually kind of slowly change a long culture, which is slow to change. And I know that from the bus industry, and I think that we can make headway, and it'll certainly be one of the top initiatives, continue to be one of the top initiatives for the agency.
Senator Chairman? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's see. I have Senator Franzen and Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I don't have a question. I have more of a comment for the record, because I'm really, truly excited to have you as the appointed person from the governor to take this role. We know it's a big sacrifice to do public good, and you are a business owner, and you've been distinguished both in that business community but also in our community at large. I looked at your resume. It's very impressive, not only what you've done but also what you currently are doing in different boards that you're currently serving on. So I really appreciate that. And I have to say that I've read the TFAC report, so that all 97 pages, a lot of graphs there, but I went through it, and I was really impressed of the thoughtful approach, and I know it was a collaborative effort, but that really drew me to be a strong advocate, I guess, for your appointment here, because it seems to be the vision that you have and share for our state, and we do need to people who are going to be strong advocates to visualize and have a vision for the transportation needs of our future, and I think you do possess that. So I'm happy to support your appointment, and I hope we can get to our vote soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
You're my new favorite member of this committee. Great. Thank you. Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Just once again, a question that sort of arose as just thinking about you in this position. You've had some 20 years or so of experience in the transportation community, and during that time, I cannot believe that, because we all would find some level of criticality with respect to certain state agencies, and I would believe that you being in transportation, there were a time or two when you were critical of MnDOT. And could you, as you think about MnDOT in your life, and I'm sure it wasn't always perfect, are there some areas within MnDOT that frustrated you at times that you thought we ought to be able to do better?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, well, the wonderful thing about being a president of Jefferson Lines is we serve 13 heartland states, from Billings, Montana, and Wisconsin, down to Arkansas. So having sat at the Arkansas Highway Commission in Fort Smith and Little Rock and in Kansas and in Missouri, and this sounds like I'm just biased from my hometown, but MnDOT was always a really refreshing agency among, and every DOT is different, so I actually learned, and I hate to say that because now I work with my peer agencies, but I thought MnDOT was very thorough and thoughtful. I think any time working with as a private operator with a public agency, there's moments where you're kind of wondering, you know, why they haven't responded in 6 weeks, and, you know, I have those frustrations, as I think many people do, and you know, but I think that's pretty normal. I haven't had any strong, you know, bad experiences. And I think I've had good experiences with state agencies generally, but I have always found MnDOT to be more thoughtful and more thorough than others, which is, I think, one of the reasons I thought I had a good feeling coming in.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything further, members? So Commissioner Franzen gave most of my speech, and I'll save most of my thoughts for the floor, but I'll just express that I've known you for quite a while, and I was pleased when the governor appointed you. I know your civic mindedness, your engagement, helping, you know, spending a lot of your own time working in community, trying to solve a lot of them, not just on transportation issues, but on a lot of issues across the board. So I appreciate your breadth of experience and your perspective, and I'm pleased to support your nomination to be Commissioner of Transportation.
Vice Chair Kent, do you have a motion?
That said, Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Committee on Transportation and Public Safety recommend that the Senate consent to and confirm the appointment of Charles Zelli as Commissioner of the Department of Transportation.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes.
Thank you, everyone.
All right. All right. Well, members, that wasn't too bad. We still have an hour and 15 minutes to hear from the Department of Public Safety their agency overview and their budget. Hopefully that's doable. Commissioner, if that is, if that isn't, you know, we'll figure something out. But I think that it probably should be all right. So welcome to the committee. So Commissioner Dolman, you've been confirmed. We're all good.
Mr. Chair, yes.
All right, excellent.
They took care of that early on, so.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Proceed as you will.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Mona Doman, and I am the Commissioner of Public Safety. I know some of you, not necessarily all of you, but I look forward to working with you all. And we are here honored to be able to present our overview of our budget and for the 2014-15 biennium. We really view this as the beginning of a conversation, as a kickoff to many conversations that we'll be having with you about our budget. There it is. And we look forward to working with you and being able to answer all of the questions that you might have as we move forward. So this agency serves as the backbone, I like to call it, for supporting public safety efforts throughout Minnesota. Through the provisions of enforcement, service, funding, training, and education, as well as legislative and policy development, our work strengthens the overall public safety infrastructure across the state of Minnesota. We strive literally every day in the work that we do in our diverse and complex agencies to ensure that people in Minnesota are safe. We work to protect communities and the citizens within them. And as I mentioned, our work is complex and it is diverse, and you'll see that as we move forward and as you look at the screen and look at our at the divisions. But we work on prevention, preparedness, response, recovery, education, and enforcement, literally in all of our divisions. Key in all of our work is the strong relationships and the maintenance of trust that we build with all of you and that we build with the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Our agency is unique in that legislative oversight jurisdiction of the Department of Public Safety Operations Divisions is split between transportation-related divisions, primarily funded by trunk highway or federal funds, and then public safety-related divisions, primarily funded by the general fund, special revenue, and federal funds. As you can see on the screen, we move forward. There they are. The divisions are separated out. I believe that you all also have a packet or have received a packet of information from us which includes an overview of each of the divisions, or it's a fact sheet more or less. And additionally, we have with us today our division directors and supporting staff to answer any specific questions that you might have as our Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison goes through the presentation. And I will now turn it over to Mary Ellison, our Deputy Commissioner, to give the overview.
Welcome to the Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As the Commissioner mentioned, we typically have been split in terms of how our budget has been presented and the oversight of our budget between transportation committees and public safety committees. It's still split in the House, but for this year, for the first time in the Senate, this committee has jurisdiction over both the transportation and public safety areas. So you can see here on the screen all of the diversity of our department. Within the transportation area, we have the Minnesota State Patrol, Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Pipeline Safety, Administration and Related Services. Within the public safety area, we have the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the Fire Marshal's Office, the Office of Justice Programs, and the Emergency Communication Networks.
Deputy Commissioner, I know a number of the division heads are in the audience. Would you mind introducing them, having them stand or wave their hands?
I would be happy to do that, Mr. Chair. First of all, we have Colonel Daly of the Minnesota State Patrol. And
with him is Captain Silky. Or you are a major. Did I demote you? Major Silky. I'm sorry. She's responsible for our commercial vehicle operations. We have Ms. Jerry Bear, who is director of the Office of Justice Programs. We have Jackie Mines, who is director of our Emergency Communication Networks. And behind her is Assistant Commissioner Mark Danaski, formerly the Colonel of the State Patrol.
He's wearing his civvies, I see now.
We have Donna Berger, who is director of our Office of Traffic Safety. We have Chris Eide, who is director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We have Pat McCormick. Many of you have worked with Pat before. She's director of Driver and Vehicle Services. We have Wade Setter, who is the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and next to him is the assistant superintendent, Drew Evans. We have Dana Goetz, who is the director of the MINJIS program, which is the Minnesota Justice Information System, and I'll explain a little bit more about that as we go through the presentation. And then Frank Dolish, who is the director of the Forensic Laboratory for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Did I miss anybody? Oh, I'm sorry. We have Michelle Tucker with us, who is director of our Alcohol and Gambling Division, and then we also have our Communications Director, Bruce Gordon, who put together this beautiful presentation for you to... And then we have Larry Freund, who is here. He's our Budget Director, and we have Jerry Rosendahl, who is the State Fire Marshal. Who am I missing? And Jared Jordahl, of course, our Director of Legislative Affairs.
All right. That's great. Well, thank you. Welcome to all of you, and we're pleased to put faces with names and members, all these folks, if you have questions or ideas. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The total of all funds that will be under the jurisdiction of this committee are $608,577,000. 29% comes from the Trunk Highway Fund, 20%, which is state government special revenue funds. Highway user tax distribution funding is 3%, miscellaneous special revenue 20%, and general fund 28%. In terms of expenses, 49%, nearly 50% of the money that we spend is on compensation. 22% is on other operating costs, which is everything other than compensation that relates to our activities like rent and office supplies and all of the different fuel and all of the different things that we need to run the agency. A local assistance is 16%, and transfers to other units of government is 12%, and payments to individuals is 1%. The governor's recommendations in the transportation area is soft body armor, and I will be going through these in more detail as we progress here. A request for an increase in funding that goes to soft body armor, which are the vests that police officers wear in the line of duty. DVS staffing increase in to address the motor vehicle title turnaround problem. DVS staffing for facial recognition. We need to replace our DVS phone system. We're also requesting additional funding for the State Patrol for fuel. And there is a request, it's actually a placeholder request so that the legislature has a chance to weigh in, but it has to do with capital security.
Deputy Commissioner, the facial recognition that relates to driver's licenses and fraudulent efforts to obtain driver's licenses fraudulently?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We have completed a scrub of our database, and we want to continue to use facial recognition as we move forward so that as people apply for driver's licenses, it's a regular part of the process.
It's not when you're walking through the mall and tracking people's whereabouts.
Correct. It only has to do with the driver's licenses.
Sure.
Yes.
So that term gets people's attention. Thank you.
Administration and related services is within our agency is funded through this committee. That includes the Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technology and Support Services, which now under new Minute IT is the money that we provide to Minute IT for providing those services to our agency.
The first budget change item is for soft body armor. Under Minnesota statutes 299A.38, law enforcement agencies can be reimbursed up to 50% of the cost of body armor for officers. The program base has been $508,000 for a number of years. That's from the general fund. Last year, we requested a one-time infusion of funds because we had such a backlog of officers that needed vests. We are caught up now, but we still see that we are about $92,000 short each year in terms of the numbers of requests that we get and the funding that we have available. And then we're also asking for an additional $100,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund to pay for the body armor that our state troopers wear.
And about how many vests or how many individuals would that serve per year?
We, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we buy about 1,600 vests per year.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Goldman.
And members, just so the committee is aware, vests are the life cycle of a vest is 5 years, as manufacturers recommend.
Next, we'll talk about the State Patrol. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. 788 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. Their annual operating budget is $83,116,000. For the fiscal year 14-15 biennium, they receive $158,378,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund. That's the proposal. $1,570,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. $6,284,000 from the General Fund. And they also get about $16 million in federal funds. Their services include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, vehicle crimes unit, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigation services, public information. There's a training academy, radio communication services, special response team, and then, of course, they have various federal programs that they operate. In 2012, state troopers logged 18.6 million patrol miles. The continuing high gas prices are a major hit to the state patrol's budget. The governor is recommending an additional $1 million per year from the Trunk Highway Fund to purchase fuel. What happens is that for every dime that goes up in the price per gallon, that really equates to one less trooper position that we can fill if we don't have that money in the budget. So it really relates very directly to the number of troopers that were available to be on the road.
So, Commissioner, gas is actually kind of low right now. Do we make this based on, have we gauged the budget to a certain price per gallon, or what forecast is, or how do we make that determination?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that you're right, the price does fluctuate that, but we have based this on the price per gallon at the time we submitted the budget and the number of miles that we log per year. So there will be some fluctuation in that, and we can certainly give you some updated figures as we move forward in the budget session.
Thank you.
The next budget change item is relates to capital security. There was a permanent advisory committee that was created last session to study capital area security. One of the committee's recommendations was increased funding. The committee report was due after our budget proposals had already been submitted. The governor asked for a $500,000 per year general fund placeholder, and the thought then was that the legislative committees would be able to study the report and take in what the recommendations were and then make some decisions from there.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for commenting on our report. Senator Benson and I serve on the on that Capital Security Task Force along with Commissioner Donansky, and our report has been filed, and the legislation is currently at the revisor's office. Senator Benson will be the chief author of the bill in the Senate, and Representative Woodard in the House. So that report, or the jacketed bill, as soon as we get it back, will be sent to your committee or our committee here.
Thank you, Senator Reston. Members, you've received a link to that report and that long list of reports that we sent out a couple of weeks ago. So look to that email, you can find that link, and read the report for yourself. We look forward to the hearing and finding out what's being advised in the form of legislation and how much it is.
And Mr. Chairman, in addition to suggesting a permanent governance structure, we are recommending considerable more. The dollars are for personnel, increase in personnel and security in the building.
While I'm thinking of it, apparently it's the job of the security personnel to hold the key that makes our doors accessible with the little touch pads for folks with mobility impairments. And whether or not those get turned on any given day is fairly inconsistent. So hopefully your funding will provide enough personnel that gets covered at the open of business every day.
Mr. Chairman, the two doors on the north side, they're always open without a key card during the session for handicapped accessibility. They are not. The red light is on when we're not in session.
Senator Rest, the access to my own office, and I suspect other office suites, is often not turned on in the morning at the start of business, and we have to call to have it turned on.
To get into your own office, Mr. Chairman?
Correct, to get into our office suite. They're just not handled on a regular basis, and so people with disabilities can't get into my office suite.
Don't you have a key?
Only the security has the key to turn the red light to green.
Make Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you certainly have the right people here to address that concern.
All right.
Mr. Chairman,
it's been a problem for a while, and so we'd like to just have it solved.
Mr. Chairman, do you mean the big door to go outside?
No, into my own office suite, room 111, where I have my offices. We each have a little pad that opens the doors.
I get it.
Right, and it's turned to red at night, it's turned to green during the day. So that it actually works.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have that issue up on the second floor, but I have a key to the door I can open it with a key to the door, but it's never.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the handicap accessibility punch pad.
Right.
So the door swings open so someone can come into my office.
It's very well attended to on the second floor.
All right.
I'll put it that way. Not a problem
floor.
There.
All right. Yeah. Well, room 111 needs a clock a.m. at the latest needs to have his handicap accessibility.
Mr. Chair, we'll have somebody look into
thank
that.
Thank you.
Next
we
up
call
is
every day, so thank you.
Next up is the Office of Traffic Safety. Their mission is to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing human behavior in Minnesota through policy development and support, stakeholder engagement, program delivery, leadership, and research and evaluation. The Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000 a year. This is a required match which allows the Office of Traffic Safety to secure federal funds, grants, and one-time monies that annually amount to about $20 million. Their services are outreach, impaired driving prevention, promotion of seatbelt use, child passenger safety, traffic records and data systems to analyze what's happening on our roadways, safe road coalitions, a motorcycle safety program, programs for teen drivers, underage alcohol prevention, distracted driving prevention, traffic safety research and analysis, and a fatality analysis record system. Questions about that? Okay. The next division that we want to talk about is driver and vehicle services. Their mission is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. DVS has an annual budget of approximately $55 million per year. They have 505 employees working in 95 locations throughout the state. They collect more than $1 billion in state revenue. DVS is funded by the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and we will be talking about the special revenue funds that DVS has a little bit later in the presentation as well. DVS services include title and registration, the auto dealer licensing and inspection division, prorate services, driver exams, driver compliance, driver license issuing, a public information center, operations support, and e-business options. One of the change items that we're requesting is an increase in our appropriation.
Commissioner, Senator Osmond.
I'll let her finish that. I just had a question. I'm not sure where to insert it.
Okay. Thanks. Carry on.
One of the requests that we have is an increase in our appropriations. In 2005, and this relates to something we'll be talking about later as well, the funding for DVS was changed so that we receive funding for the operation of DVS services through special revenue accounts. Those special revenue accounts are made up of the fees that people pay when they get a new driver's license or get a title. So these are the fees that are similar to the fees or actually identical to the fees that are charged by deputy registrars throughout the state of Minnesota. We went to the creation of special revenue funds because the fluctuation in the budget that was allocated for DVS was severe, and we had to actually at one point lay off 86 people, and that led to a change in the way that DVS is funded, and we have special revenue funds that we put into an account, actually to two accounts. One is the driver services account, and the other is the vehicle services account. So fees that you pay on driver's license transactions or that citizens pay goes into the driver account, and for vehicle transactions, it goes into the vehicle account. Then what happens is we have to get appropriation authority to spend those funds from the legislature. One of the problems that we've been dealing with in the past few years is the amount of time that it takes to turn around a vehicle title. It's been upwards of 90 days to issue a new title, and we have been involved in process improvement efforts for about the past year. And we now have the title turnaround on average down to about 60 days, but our goal is 30 days. And when it gets longer than about 45 days, there's a hue and cry from citizens. I'm sure some of you have gotten questions from constituents. Through our process improvement efforts, we held off in asking for increased revenue to solve this problem until we completed some of the process improvements that we needed to complete. We have now done that, and even with the process improvement strategies that we put into place, we feel that we need seven additional people to get the title turnaround time down to 30 days. So the request is for $650,000 in increased appropriation authority from our special revenue funds to hire additional people for this purpose.
Thank you. Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, if you were here earlier, you heard some questions regarding, and with the last presentation, regarding license recognition software that is becoming more and more popular. It appears across different jurisdictions. I wasn't sure if it was State Patrol or if it fell in maybe into this category. Is that something, I guess, looking at your entire presentation, is that something in the direction that these agencies are going as far as collecting data, or are we looking at large databases of is this software going to be used by MnDOT or by your services or by your committee, your areas? And if so, to what extent, how long is data going to be held because there are some very serious concerns about for Fourth Amendment issues and possible legislation, as the chair alluded to, as far as how long some of that data can be held.
And specifically, where I believe we're talking about license plate recognition and location software, like the city of Minneapolis
right.
and city of St. Paul are using.
Right, and Minneapolis, I believe they have 10 units that are using it, and it's becoming more and more popular. I'm trying to figure out how much that may be going in the direction of the state patrol and state agencies, so that if there is legislation, that we properly address it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, before, when you were asking the Department of Transportation, you correlated it with facial recognition software, and they're two very, very different things. And so at some point we could go into the difference. But basically, license plate readers take a snapshot of the license plate, and then that data is compared against cars that are stolen so that law enforcement officers can do something about the fact that the car is stolen. I'm going to let Commissioner Doman talk more specifically about that because she certainly has more expertise in that than I do.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, and members, license plate reader, to just give a snapshot of what it is, it is a snapshot of a license plate, and then it documents the time and the date and the location that the vehicle, that picture was taken. And so that is the data that is housed at the agency that owns or operates the license plate reader tool. The state of Minnesota does not... The BCA does not house any of that data. The data that is collected from the license plate reader hits on our hot files database at the BCA, which is stolen vehicles entered. So let's say a vehicle is involved in an abduction, for instance, or it is stolen. It hits on our file there and then gives a read back to law enforcement as to whether or not that's a wanted vehicle. And so... And the Minnesota State Patrol does use license plate reader units, and so do many agencies around the state of Minnesota. And I think if we've all been watching the news, we recognize that there is no law that says how long the data should be retained or when it should be purged, and then what the classification of that data. It is not classified in statute. And so it is public information. And so I would hope that as we move forward, we'll have that discussion in the interest of considering the need for how long the information would be valuable to law enforcement without it being housed for too long. But if you think about maybe your own situation, you leave town, your vehicle is stolen while you're out of town, you come back, you realize your vehicle is stolen, it might not be an instant report to law enforcement to get that vehicle entered as stolen. And so, you know, there are some who might say they would like the data purged instantly once it has hit the hot files at the BCA. If it doesn't come up as a flag, there's some that think that the data should be purged instantly. And then there are some agencies that are holding it, I think, upwards of 90 or 180 days. And so anywhere in between there.
Commissioner, I have a strong view of the subject. It's probably not consistent with yours. I would hope we wouldn't get into this specifics of this discussion here. We are going to have a proposal. I have a proposal. I suspect others will have a proposal. I'm not going to take the opportunity to lobby the merits of what I view, but, you know, we've got some material to get through. Senator Hifmeyer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the finances part of it under DVS, in the presentation here, it says that you have an annual budget of approximately $55 million, but $1 billion in state revenue. So of the $1 billion in state revenue, only $55 goes for you to do the DVS work. Am I reading that accurately?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, the $1 billion relates to all of the taxes that are collected, the fees that are collected, everything that's collected related to drivers and vehicles in the state of Minnesota. And so, yes, we have a much smaller subset because that money, the greatest share of that money goes into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and then from there it goes to the Department of Transportation or for transportation-related activities.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think the expectation of people when they pay fees for things like this is to get a service. They have paid for motor vehicle licensing. They pay an extra fee above their regular taxes, and the same thing with their driver's licenses. And my understanding, or my expectation before, was there was more of a close match, like state law requires, is that if you collect a fee for a particular service, you don't collect more than that to do the extra service. So
Understand their question. This figure also includes taxes that are collected for the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, like the license tab fee, for example, is a tax. The vehicle titling tax. So this doesn't include just the fee for service for titling, et cetera. These are also the taxes collected for the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund.
That's why I'm trying to get at that, Mr. Chairman, and because it's such a great big gap there. But the other question I still do have, though, is in that $55 million in your driver's license fees that you collect and the motor vehicle fees that you mentioned in particular, does that add up to $55 million or less?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
Commissioner,
that amount fluctuates each year as the amount of money that goes into the each special revenue account. But, yes, we are able to cover our expenses with the fees that we collect on transactions. And currently, there is a bit of a reserve that has been built up because each year we have to request our appropriation authority from the legislature. The legislature appropriates so much, and then if we collect more than what we have been appropriated to spend, that sits in the special revenue account and then is transferred from one year to the other.
So, okay. Senator Kiffmeyer, hang on to your question, though, because I think there will be uses of this money, the fee money, for other purposes. Later, not the taxes that go into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, like the license tab fees, but the fee for service, that excess, is being utilized for other purposes. I think we'll hear about later on in the presentation. So,
right, Mr. Chairman, I do look forward to hearing more about that because I think, especially in this area, the turnaround is constituents bring it up, and I see some change items that I think would be helpful in that regard. So I just. But I know that this is not the full presentation of their actual budget book and all that stuff. So I just, we're just such a big gap, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to be sure. But thank you. I don't need to go any further.
Right.
But
and
I will
we can,
hold.
You know, to make this clear, and it's a good question, but yeah, $1 billion and, you know, it only costs 55. It's a big gap. But it's kind of apples and oranges here. And maybe we can benefit from a chart or a pie chart that shows what that $1 billion is. Senator Pratt.
Thank you. So I think Senator Kiffmeyer touched on the first part of my question, which is the special revenue account. So if I were to just clarify, it's excess tax revenue that was collected above and beyond what was appropriated by the legislature?
Fee revenue. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Fee revenue. Deputy Commissioner.
Senator Pratt, I'm sorry. As the chairman said, it is a little bit of apples and oranges. Through the various driver and vehicle taxes that we collect, so, for instance, when you buy a car, you pay taxes, or when you renew your tabs every year, you pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
All of that money equates to about $1 billion a year. That money goes into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and then is by statute or by legislative appropriation given for roads and bridges and all kinds of different transportation-related activities. In 2005, the decision was made by the legislature to fund the operations of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division through the fees that are charged. So, for instance, whether you go to a deputy registrar's office or you mail in your transaction, you pay like a $3 fee or a $3.50 fee. Those are the fees that go into the special revenue accounts that then are used by DVS to pay their salaries and rent and all of the activities associated with operating the business.
Sorry, I misspoke. I meant fees, taxes, fees. Right. I'm still learning.
All right.
One additional follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're talking about $650,000 for 7 FTEs. I appreciate the focus on customer service. At a cost of $90,000 per FTE, what type of people are we looking at? What are the problems that are causing the turnarounds? At a very high level and briefly, what are some of the issues that you're finding are causing the delays?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, the legislature has a tendency to change the laws every year, and there are oftentimes changes with what goes into transferring a motor vehicle title. The title turnaround is not related to new cars. That's about three, I think it's 5 to 7 days to turn that around, maybe even 3 days. But it's for transferring used cars. And so there's a lot of study and checking of statutes that have to go into when you're transferring a title. The other issue that impacts it is the federal government passed the National Vehicle Title Information System Act, which means that we need to, when we get a title, check the federal database to make sure that it's not either a stolen vehicle or a vehicle that was in a flood or all kinds of things that could relate to not really being a good idea to purchase that vehicle or transfer the title. So a lot of it relates to the complexity. What we've been doing for the past year is that we've had a process improvement person working with the unit to change the way that they are distributing titles to the staff, the way that the staff are being trained, and the number of handoffs, for instance, for decision making. So in a nutshell, those are the activities that we've taken to try to get the process down to as lean as possible. But we're still needing additional staff in order to bring the turnaround time down to 30 days, which is our goal.
I guess my question in part is at $90,000 per FTE, that seems more than clerical. Or is the idea to fund the process improvement staff through your request?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, it's for the whole process. It certainly is for the staff, it's for computers, it's for their office space, it's for their retirement benefits, sick leave, vacation, all of that is included in the price per person.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I have a clarification here?
Senator Thomason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Repeat what you said, Deputy Commissioner, about the issuance of titles on cars that might have been in floods or that might have been stolen. But aren't we talking about transferring a title after a person purchases the vehicle? Right, isn't that what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thomason, yes, but sometimes those issues aren't discovered until the title is in our hands, and then we have to, by federal law, compare that title against the federal title system to get a true history of that car, where it's been. And
so if I buy a car that was in a flood,
Senator Thomason,
and you find out 90 days later that I purchased a car that was in a flood, what do you do then?
Mr. Chair,
what do I do?
Senator Thomason, I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick, our Driver and Vehicle Services Director, because to answer that question, that's deeper than what I have knowledge of.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. If there is a problem with the owner not knowing about a vehicle that was damaged in some way or a flood vehicle, then that title is returned to that individual, and then that individual can determine if they want to talk with the dealership or whatever, because it wasn't truth in them not providing that information to the individual. It depends on the situation, but we would always be giving that information to the owner of the vehicle so that they would be able to take action if necessary, or we'd also may request law enforcement's investigation or work with an insurance company. It just depends on the situation, and if there was a brand or there looked like there could be fraud or flood damage. Then we would have to notify that owner that we had found that out, and we would have to be able to trace the information back to the state of record where the title came from.
And so,
Senator Thomason.
Mr. Chair, and then does the person who bought the vehicle have recourse against the person that sold them the vehicle once this is
Well, I wouldn't be able to give you any Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I wouldn't be able to give you any specifics unless I had a case to be able to give you as an example. So it might be helpful if I did that and sent that to the committee members so you had more information as to how we are able to use the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System, but it is required on any vehicles that are transferred that we have to check on that history to make sure it's accurate and the owner was aware of the accuracy of the vehicle record. So I'd be glad to provide you with more information and details on the specific example you gave me, but I wouldn't be able to do that without talking it through with our title staff. So.
I don't know if I gave you a specific example other than I heard the deputy commissioner talk about vehicles that were in floods. Or I mean, I've seen titles that are blemished, but then at that point you know it's a blemish. But in the event that you purchase a vehicle where there wasn't full disclosure, then and you find out about it when in your title search, then the person who bought the vehicle may have some rights in regards to whether or not they want to keep the vehicle and whether or not they can get their money back. Is that kind of
correct.
What we're going through here?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, yes, that would be correct.
Okay. And members, I'll just introduce you. She was introduced earlier, but this is Pat McCormick, who heads up Driver and Vehicle Services, who can help you with problems that are often brought to your attention. Probably the most common problem that's brought to my attention are hiccups in titling or driver's licenses or stuff like that. Just give Pat a call. She'll help you out. She does every time. Thanks. Deputy Commissioner.
The next proposal that we have to discuss is regarding our facial recognition software. Facial recognition is used to scan the database of Minnesota driver's license and ID photos for fraudulent duplicates. Findings are instrumental in combating identity-based fraud across the public and private sectors. As I stated briefly before, we completed a scrub of our database and found issues where people seem to have the same picture on multiple driver's licenses with different names. And so we did a facial scrub of 11 million of our photos and identified about 1 million driver's licenses that had to be looked at further. Then those million were sorted into, you know, potential fraud, whether somebody was an identical twin or had changed their appearance or gotten married. We ended up with that process canceling about 10,252 driver's licenses where fraud was suspected. What we want to do with this software is we intend to have it be a regular part of the application process as we move forward. So we've completed the scrub of the photos that are currently in the database, and then we intend to move forward with this facial recognition program. As you can imagine, it does involve, at some point, real people looking at the pictures to determine whether or not fraud is suspected. And so what we're requesting is for $71,000 per year beginning in 2015 to fund a full-time person to be the supervisor of the facial recognition fraud prevention unit. The next change item request is for the DVS phone system. The phone system is 10 years old and it handles a tremendous number of calls. And we are looking to implement a new system, and we are requesting $150,000 in fiscal year 15 and $650,000 in the 16 and 17 biennium, and that will replace the phone system. And again, this is a request for increased appropriation authority from our special revenue funds. Next is the Office of Pipeline Safety. Their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident, and incident investigations, and education. They have a budget of $3.13 million per year, and that comes from special revenue and federal funds. $1.35 million per year is a direct appropriation from the special revenue fund, and that special revenue fund is made up of inspection fees, pipeline inspection fees. This is the governor's, a list of the governor's recommendations regarding the public safety divisions within our agency. First two relate to the criminal history. One is to replace the state's criminal history system. The next is to replace the state's crime reporting system. We are requesting increased funding for forensic laboratory equipment replacement, forensic laboratory staffing, maintenance of live scan fingerprint machines, expansion of background checks, armor maintenance, that's the 800 megahertz emergency communication system, and then for the Minnesota School Safety Center. First of all, I'll talk a little bit about the divisions in the public safety area. The first is the state fire marshal. The mission is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment. Their funding is a mix of fire safety account money and other special revenue funds that come from inspection fees. For fiscal year 14-15, they have a $10.159 million budget through the special revenue and direct appropriations. The fire marshal services include investigation, enforcement, regulation, emergency response, data collection, and public education. Next is the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Their mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor the state tribal gaming compacts. They issue alcohol beverage licenses and permits. They do brand label registration, investigate alcohol-related complaints and investigations of licensed premises, alcohol promotion and advertising oversight, imposition of civil penalties, enforcement of the underage drinking law, and the retail alcohol vendor enforcement program. On the gambling side, they license the manufacturers and distributors of gambling equipment in the state of Minnesota. They assure compliance with the state tribal compacts, and they do gambling, criminal enforcement, and investigative activities. Their budget for fiscal years 14 and 15 is $1.58 million per year in general fund and $653,000 per year in special revenue direct appropriations. Special revenue monies are derived from the Indian Nation compacts, criminal background fees, and gambling forfeiture proceedings. Next is Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. In addition to extensive program activity, HSEM is a pass-through agency for very sizable federal grant amounts. General fund base for the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division is $1.851 million per year. Funding sources through federal grants, mostly from Homeland Security and FEMA, are approximately $20 million. In fiscal year 15, Homeland Security and Emergency Management will expend approximately $48 million in assistance to over 300 governments and other entities here in the state of Minnesota. Their services include emergency preparedness, planning and response, pre-disaster mitigation, post-disaster recovery, critical infrastructure protection, the Community Right to Know Act, training exercises and simulations, coordination of statewide and volunteer resources, and they administer, of course, large amounts of federal programs. A change item that affects this division is the School Safety Center. Minnesota previously had a school safety center that was funded through federal grants that assisted schools with emergency preparedness, response, and recovery activities. The recommendation is an allocation from the general fund of $555,000 in fiscal year 14 and $505,000 in fiscal year 15 and forward to reestablish that center. And that will be able to, we would be able to add five full-time positions and necessary equipment and resources to fund the school safety center. The Office of Justice Programs. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist victims of crime. In fiscal years 14 and 15, the general fund direct appropriation for them is $32.96 million per year. In addition to direct program through the crime victim reparations activities, Office of Justice Program administers grants to nonprofits and local units of government totaling about $50 million per year. OJP services include the Crime Victim Reparations Unit, Crime Victim Justice Unit, grants to local programs for assistance to crime victims, including general crime, abused children, battered women and domestic violence, sexual assault, and emergency grant programs. They also provide training in communication, a statistical analysis center, and justice and community grants to reduce crime, reduce delinquency, reduce drug abuse, and prevent violence. Next is the Emergency Communications Networks. Their mission is to utilize emerging technologies to provide the most comprehensive emergency communication networks available. By developing professional partnerships and collaborating with our customers, we will deliver customer-focused network solutions that enhance public safety. For fiscal years 14 and 15, approximately $62 million per year from the 911 emergency services account of the Special Revenue Fund will be expended. And that is for the Special Revenue Fund comes from the amount that you pay each time you pay your phone bill. There's a surcharge on there that goes into the Special Revenue Account, and that's used to build and maintain the 800 megahertz emergency communication system that's deployed right now in about 86% of the state and will be fully deployed, hopefully, by the end of 2013. The other area that the emergency communication networks provide services in is for the 911 emergency dispatch. They collect a monthly fee assessed, again, upon all wired, wireless, and pocket-based telecommunication services. And they have contracts with telephone companies to provide the 911 network. Through the emergency communications networks, they provide grants to public safety answering points throughout the state of Minnesota, provides technical assistance to the public safety answering points, and is developing the migration strategy for next generation 911. And next generation 911 includes the ability to handle text messages in addition to voice messages. The governor's recommendation here is that the our emergency communications networks is in charge of developing the emergency communication system, but MnDOT owns and operates the towers. And so what we are requesting is an additional appropriation from the Special Revenue Fund to go to MnDOT of $600,000 in fiscal year 14 and $1 million in fiscal year 15 to maintain the communication towers throughout the state of Minnesota. So it would be a transfer from us to MnDOT. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Their mission is to protect Minnesotans and all who visit our state by providing services to prevent and solve crimes in partnership with law enforcement, public safety, and other criminal justice agencies. Their services include special agents and analysts, predatory offender registration, investigation assistance, financial crimes task force, cold case assistance, the Internet Crimes Against Children program, and the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center. Their administrative services include the Criminal Justice Law Enforcement Training and Education Program, the Amber Alert Program, Missing and Identified Persons Programs, the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, the DARE Program, Minnesota Crime Watch Program, Statewide Internet Safety Education Program, and then there are 24-hour duty officers that provide staffing. For forensic services, we have our forensics laboratory that does drug analysis, nuclear and mitochondrial DNA analysis, firearms analysis, National Integrated Ballistics Identification Network, the Midwest Automated Fingerprint Identification Network. We have a fingerprint laboratory, a documents laboratory, a combined DNA indexing system, breath alcohol testing laboratory, toxicology laboratory, trace laboratory, crime scene service training and accreditation. And we have a lab here in St. Paul and then one in Bemidji.
Deputy Commissioner, you provide accreditation services to other labs?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not provide accreditation service to other labs. There is a national association that provides that accreditation.
What does that bullet point accreditation refer to then? Becoming accredited?
We are accredited. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are accredited, yes.
So that refers to the work you have to do to become accredited?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it does refer to that, but also we are able to provide scientists. The national group that accredits crime laboratories asks for some of our forensic science experts to participate in accrediting other state crime labs.
Thank you.
The Minnesota Justice Information Service includes what used to be called CrimNet, which is the ability to connect up all the disparate data systems that local units, police and fire, or police and sheriffs and the courts use. The Criminal Justice Data Communications Network, Criminal History Background Checks, Criminal Justice Reporting System, Maintenance and Administration of Criminal Justice Information Systems, Development Services for Information Systems, Fingerprint Services, Technical Support, and Training and Auditing. I realize that we're going through a lot of information very quickly, and I know we'll have to come back because a lot of these areas are very separate and distinct and complicated.
Yes. We had some discussion, Commissioner, about CrimNet. We know that that's an aspiration rather than an actual thing, and I just want to understand that a little bit better at some point. So, thanks.
The funding for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in fiscal years 14 and 15 is a direct appropriation of $42.21 million. $40.27 million is from the general fund, and then $1.94 million from the Trunk Highway Fund. These are the two change items that are going to relate back to, there are two of these change items that are going to relate back to the DVS special revenue accounts, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions, if not today, then as we move forward with the budget presentation. First, the governor is recommending replacement of the state's crime reporting system. All states report local crime statistics to the FBI as a condition of receiving federal justice and crime-fighting grants. Minnesota's crime reporting system is outdated, hampering its functionality. We're asking for funding for a phased implementation, and we're asking for $1 million per year from the DVS special operating account and $360,000 per year from the general fund for 14 and 15, and then $1.7 million in general funds in fiscal year 16 and 17. We're also requesting funding to replace the state's criminal history system. The current system is 20 years old. It's obsolete in terms of its technology, and it makes it difficult and expensive to integrate with newer systems. This is where we keep all of the criminal justice history information on all people that commit felonies and juvenile crime and all of that in the state of Minnesota, and it's absolutely a vital system for law enforcement, the courts, corrections, probation, for state licensure, for background checks, for everything. It contains all of that criminal history information. We're requesting money to phase the development of this new system. We're asking for $4 million per year from special revenue funds and $80,000 per year from the general fund in 14 and 15, and then $2.8 million in general funds in fiscal year 16 and 17. The next budget request is for replacement of forensic laboratory equipment. Individual pieces of BCA lab equipment can cost up to $250,000. Most of the existing equipment was purchased when the BCA was built 11 years ago, and the BCA is able to budget $125,000 per year for repair and replacement. We are requesting that we create a base budget of $125,000 per year from the general fund, or we increase our base budget by $125,000 per year from the general fund and $125,000 per year from the Trunk Highway Fund so that we can begin to replace our lab equipment. The BCA operates the premier forensic lab in Minnesota and is heavily relied upon by the criminal justice system. The request here is an increase in our base of $200,000 per year in general fund and $200,000 per year from the Trunk Highway Fund to hire four new people, two drug chemists, and two toxicologists. The goal is to reduce lab turnaround time for chemical testing to 30 days. Next item is for maintenance of live scan machines. The BCA purchased and deployed, I believe it's about 177 automated live scan fingerprint machines throughout the state of Minnesota. And we agreed when we went to live scan fingerprinting that it was such an important issue that we would provide maintenance on those machines. The maintenance contracts are up, and we are requesting base funding for live scan maintenance of $310,000 per year in general fund in 14, $380,000 per year in 15 and forward.
$400,000 this biennium and $400,000 next biennium.
Expansion of background checks. The BCA conducts various statutory criminal background checks. The FBI recommends that those people that do the background checks should be subject to background checks themselves. This is really a net gain of zero. We want to be authorized to charge $21.50 for those background checks, and they are basically paid by the person that the background check is about.
And how many people are we talking about?
I guess so. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't know for sure is the answer to the question. There are people in, like, the Department of Human Services and other state agencies that conduct background checks, and they haven't been subject to a background check themselves, but we don't know exactly how many people that will be.
This include people who have access to driver's license data, by chance.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we...
Whole another subject.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to say we do look forward to that whole discussion.
All right.
Well, I wouldn't say we look forward to it, but we're certainly very open to discussing that issue and finding better solutions.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that's come up recently has been unauthorized access into your data systems. I know that these days with technology, you can do patterning just like they do on our credit cards and other things like that. You're looking at some upgrades here and some other things like that. But I think both points, whether the person is not authorized to go into your data system or when someone does, is there any sort of sensitivity there to... frequency of use or source of use or anything like that, or any sort of predictive technology that you have that can help to prevent unauthorized access into your databases?
Mr. Deputy Chair, Commissioner. Senator Kiffmeyer, the reports that you've heard of recently are not about unauthorized use. They are people that have authorized use of the DBS system, however, have chosen to use it for purposes other than what they should be using it for. So, but in answer to your question, yes, there are things that we are doing and things that we can continue to do and continue to improve upon. And I know that we're going to have a longer discussion about that topic, so unless the commissioner would like to add something, I'll just leave it at that for now.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair. I would just like to add, as the Deputy Commissioner said, we are not necessarily excited about the conversation, but we will be joining you in the conversation. And there is great sensitivity to the privacy of the information in the systems and the use of it. And so we are continually working to make sure or to do all that we can to help eliminate the misuse of the system.
Senator Kiffmeyer, you're aware that I'll be bringing a bill forward, and we also have the legislative auditor's report that's due soon, and we'll have a presentation of that report to have a more expansive discussion. I'm looking forward to that,
I'm glad to hear that. Mr. Chairman, right. That there will be more extensive, and if that's forthcoming, this will suffice.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you answered the question. Asked the question because we need to start this conversation. All right, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, just trying to reconcile, I guess, between what we have in our budget books and what was presented. I'm trying to understand the differences. So you presented general funds of $169 million. The book here shows $167 million for an increase of, with a proposed general fund expenditure through the governor's budget of $172 million, $4.4 million increase. I'm just trying to reconcile between what's in the book, what's in the presentation, what should we be looking at?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I'm going to ask Mr. Bogut or Mr. Freund to explain the differences.
My name is Larry Freund. I'm the CFO for DPS, for the record. The Mr. difference Freund. That you're seeing probably is that the slides that we presented are just our base budget, and the numbers you see in the book, the budget book I assume you're looking at, that includes initiatives that the agency is, or the governor is proposing for the agency.
Okay,
which we also refer to as
change
items.
I can do a reconciliation for the committee if they'd like on that. I don't have the two numbers in front of me right now, but that's what the difference would be, because ours specifically says it's a base budget that we're presenting in our slide, and then you add the initiatives that are the different funding sources for the initiatives, and that's in the budget books.
So if I'm looking specifically just at the general – oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So if I'm looking specifically at the base budget here, that would not tie to the current law expenditures?
Mr. Freund.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd have to look at that book there. I can put together a kind of a reconciliation of those numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freund. Anything further, members? And members – this was very fast and very high level, and we will go through the budget, particularly the change items, in some more detail as we, at some point, and certainly as we compile the committee budget, the committee bill. And Deputy Commissioner Ellison touched on some questions that we'll have to explore a little bit further, especially around some of the special revenue funds and how we're making use of those. So we'll have that conversation as well. Also, as was alluded, there will be some, you know, individual initiatives, which we'll hear in more detail, because those are being carried by members. I know, for example, the School Safety Center will be carried forward as an individual initiative that we'll have a more thorough discussion of. So we'll have some opportunity to plumb the details of these books and some of these ideas a little bit better.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, since this is my first time on the Transportation Committee, has the past budgets been this thin, or is there no information in here?
Well, this Senator Tomasoni, the transportation pieces are not in there.
They're not in there yet. Okay.
Yeah.
So
correct.
We got more to go yet. All right.
So wait
okay.
for more. Although, you know, they're not going to be. It's not going to be as thick as your committee budget book. I promise you. So, and also, I don't know. I need, you know, there's the. The material being generated out of management and budget is very different, and the narratives are a lot shorter. I would actually, speaking of some of the stuff that we used to get in the narratives in the budget books, thankfully the Department of Public Safety provided these one-sheeters. This is what we used to get in our budget books, a lot of this stuff. So I would encourage everyone to take these with you and read them. They're really interesting. So, all right, anything further, members? Anything further, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Very informative. Good conversation. What are our announcements? Members, on Wednesday we'll meet and we'll hear from the Metropolitan Council and MnDOT on their budget overview. And then, of course, we have our Thursday field trip. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.